The Cave of the Ancients by Tuesday Love Sang Rampa, read to you by Blue Friend, November 2016. Chapter 11. We were having fun. Several of us were out in the courtyard strutting around on our stilts, attempting to topple each other over. The one who could remain on the stilts, impervious to the assaults of the others, was the winner. Three of us subsided in a laughing heap. Someone had put his stilts in a hole in the ground and bumped into us, tripping us. "Old Teacher Rex was in a blue mood today, all right," said one of my companions happily. "Yes," cried another of the heap. "It should make one of the others go green with envy that he could get in such a mood and take it out on us without getting out of breath." We all looked at each other and started to laugh. A blue mood? Green with envy? We called the others to come off their stilts and sit on the ground with us, and then we started a new game. How many colors could we use in describing things? "Blue in the face," exclaimed one. "No, we've already had blue. We have already had a blue mood." So we went on, working up from blue mood to an abbot who was in a brown study, and a teacher who was green with envy. Another referred to a scarlet woman he had seen in the marketplace in Lhasa. For the moment, we did not know if that would apply, because none of us were sure what a scarlet woman was meant to be. "I know," retorted the boy to my right. "We can have a man who is yellow. He's yellow with cowardice. After all, yellow is often used to indicate cowardice." I thought about all this, and it seemed to me that if such sayings were common usage in any language, then there must be some good underlying cause behind it, and that set me off in search of my guide, the Lama Mingyur Dondup. "Honorable Lama," I burst into his study in some excitement. He looked up at me, not at all perturbed at my unceremonious entry. "Honorable Lama, why do we use colors to describe moods?" He put down the book which he was studying and motioned for me to be seated. "I suppose you are meaning those common usage terms about a blue mood or a man with green envy," he queried. "Yes," I answered in even more excitement, excitement that he should know precisely what I was referring to. "I really would like to know why all these colors are important. There must be something behind it." He looked at me and laughed, retorting, "Well, Lobsang, you have let yourself in for another nice long lecture. But I see that you have been doing some strenuous exercise, and I think that you and I might have tea." I was waiting for mine anyhow. "Before we go on with this subject." Tea was not long in coming. This time it was tea and sampa, the same as any other monk or lama or boy in the hole of the lamasery would be having. We ate in silence, I thinking about colors and wondering what the implication of colors would be. Soon we had finished our rather meager meal, and I looked at my guide expectantly. "You know a little about musical instruments, Lobsang," he commenced. You know, for example, that there is a musical instrument much used in the West, known as a piano. You will remember that together we looked at a picture of one. It contains a keyboard with a lot of notes on it, some black, some white. Well, let us forget the black ones. Let us imagine instead that we have a keyboard perhaps 2 miles long, longer if you like. It contains every vibration which can be obtained on any plane of existence. He looked at me to see if I was following, because a piano was a strange device as far as I was concerned. I, as my guide had said, had seen such a thing only in pictures. Satisfied that I could perceive the underlying idea, he continued, "If you had a keyboard containing every vibration, then the whole range of human vibrations would be in perhaps the three middle keys. You will understand, at least I hope you will, that everything consists of vibrations. Let us take the lowest vibrations known to man. The lowest vibration is that of a hard material. You touch it and it obstructs the passage of your finger. At the same time, all its molecules are vibrating. You can go further up the imaginary keyboard and you can hear a vibration known as sound. You can go higher and your eyes can receive a vibration which is known as sight." I jerked bolt upright at that. How could sight be a vibration? If I looked at a thing, well, how did I see? "You see," Lob sang, "because the article which is being viewed vibrates and creates a commotion which is perceived by the eye. In other words, an article which you can see generates a wave which can be received by the rods and cones in the eye, which in turn translates the impulses received to a portion of the brain which converts the impulses into a picture of the original article. It is all very complicated, and we do not want to go into it too thoroughly. I'm merely trying to point out to you that everything is a vibration. If we go higher up the scale, we have radio waves, telepathic waves, and the waves of those people who live on other planes. But of course, I said that we are going to limit ourselves specifically to the mythical three notes on the keyboard, which could be perceived by humans as a solid thing, as a sound, or as a sight." I had to think about all this. It was a matter which really made my brain buzz. I never minded learning. By the kind methods of my guide, the only time I jibbed at learning was when some tyrannical teacher was whacking away at my poor old robe with a thoroughly unpleasant stick. "You ask about colors," Lob sang. "Well, certain vibrations are impressed upon one's aura as colors. Thus, by way of example, if a person is feeling miserable, if he's feeling thoroughly unhappy, then part of his senses will emit a vibration or frequency which approximates to the color which we call blue, so that even people who are not clairvoyant can almost perceive the blueness. And so that color has crept into most languages throughout the world as indicating a blue mood, as an unpleasant, unhappy mood. I was beginning to get the drift of the idea now, but it still puzzled me how a person could be green with envy, and I said so. Lobsang, by deduction, you should have been able to reason for yourself that when a person is suffering from the vice known as envy, his vibrations change somewhat, so that he gives the impression to others of being green. I do not mean that his features turn green, as you're well aware, but he does give the impression of being green. I should also make it clear to you that when a person is born under a certain planetary influence, then he's affected more strongly by those colors. Yes, I burst out. I know that a person born under Aries likes red. My guide laughed at my eagerness and said, yes, that comes under the law of harmonics. Certain people respond more readily to a certain color because the vibration of that color is in close sympathy with their own basic vibration. That is why an Aries person, for example, prefers a red color, because the Aries person has much red in his makeup, and he finds the color red itself pleasant to dwell upon. I was bursting to ask a question. I knew about these greens and blues, and I could even make out why a person should be in a brown study, because when a person was concentrating on a particular form of study, his aura perhaps would be irradiated with brown flecks. But I could not understand why a woman should be scarlet. Honorable Lama, I burst out, unable to contain my curiosity any longer. Why can a woman be called a scarlet woman? My guide looked at me as if he was going to burst, and I wondered for a moment what I had said which had caused him to nearly throw a fit with suppressed amusement, and then he told me, kindly and in some detail, so that in future I should not be so unclear on any subject. I want also to tell you, Lobsang, that every person has a basic frequency of vibration. That is, every person's molecules vibrate at a certain rate, and the wavelength generated by a person's brain can fall into special groups. No two persons have the same wavelength, not the same wavelength identical in every respect. But when two people are near the same wavelength, or when their wavelength follows certain octaves of the other, then they're said to be compatible, and they usually get on very well together. I looked at him and wondered about some of our highly temperamental artists. Honorable Lama, is it true that some of the artists vibrate at a higher rate than others? I inquired. Most certainly it is, Lobsang, said my guide. If a man is to have what is known as inspiration, if he be a good artist, then his frequency of vibrations must be many times higher than normal. Sometimes it makes him irritable, difficult to get on with. Being of a higher rate of vibration than most of us, he tends to look down on us lesser mortals. However, often the work that he turns out is so good that we can put up with his slight fads and fancies. I imagine this great keyboard stretching for several miles, and it did seem to me a strange thing that, if in a keyboard stretching several miles, the human range of experiences would be limited to only about 3 notes, and I said so. The human being, Lob sang, likes to think that he's the only thing in creation that is important, you know. Actually, there are many, many other forms of life besides humans. On other planets, there are forms of life which are utterly alien to humans, and the average human could not even begin to understand such a form of life. On our mythical keyboard, the inhabitants of a planet far, far removed from this particular universe would be right away at a different end of the keyboard from that of the humans. Again, people on the astral planes of existence would be higher up the keyboard, for a ghost who can walk through a wall is of such a tenuous nature that his own rate of vibrations would be high indeed, although his molecular content would be low. He looked at me and laughed at my puzzled expression and then explained, "Well, you see, a ghost can pass through a stone wall because a stone wall consists of molecules in vibration. There are spaces between every molecule, and if you can get a creature with molecules so small that they can fit between the spaces of a stone wall, then that particular creature would be able to walk through a stone wall with no obstruction whatever. Of course, the astral creatures have a very high rate of vibration, and they are of a tenuous nature, that is, they're not solid, which in its turn means that they have few molecules. Most people imagine that the space beyond our Earth, beyond the edge of the air above us, is empty. That is not so. Space has molecules throughout. They are mostly hydrogen molecules, which are widely dispersed. But the molecules are there, and they can indeed be measured in much the same way as can the presence of a so-called ghost be measured." The temple conches sounded, calling us once again to our services. "We will talk about this again tomorrow," Lob sang, "because I want you to be very clear on this subject," said my guide, as we parted at the entrance to the temple. The ending of the temple service was the start of a race to get food. We were all rather hungry, for our own food supplies were exhausted. This was the day when a new supply of freshly roasted barley was available. In Tibet, all monks carry a small leather pouch of barley, which has been roasted and ground, and which, by the addition of buttered tea, becomes sampa. So we raced on, and soon joined the throng waiting to have their bags filled. Then we went to the hall, where tea was available so that we could have our evening meal. The stuff was terrible. I chewed at my sampa and wondered if my stomach was wrong. There was a horrible oily, burnt taste to it, and I really did not know how I was going to get it down. "Ugh," muttered the boy next to me, "this stuff has been burnt to a frazzle. None of us will be able to cram it down." "It seems to me that everything has been spoiled in this lot of food," I said. I tried a bit more, screwing up my face in anxious concentration, wondering how I was going to cram it down. "In Tibet, to waste food is a great offense." I looked about me and saw the others were looking about them. The Sampa was bad, there was no doubt about that. Everywhere, bowls were being put down, and that was a very rare occurrence in our community, where everyone was always just on the point of hunger. I hastily swallowed the Sampa in my mouth, and something very strange about it hit me with unexpected force in the stomach. Hastily scrambling to my feet and apprehensively holding my mouth with my hand, I bolted for the door. "Well, young man," said a strangely accented voice, as I turned back towards the door, after having violently ejected the disturbing food, I turned and saw Kenji Takuchi, the Japanese monk who had been everywhere, seen everything, and done everything, and was now paying for it by way of periodic bouts of mental instability. He looked sympathetically at me. "Vile stuff, isn't it?" he remarked sympathetically. "I had the same difficulty as you, and I came out here for the same reason. We shall have to see what happens. I'm staying out for a few minutes, hoping the fresh air will blow away some of the miasma which this bad food has caused." "Sir," I said diffidently, "you have been everywhere, and would you tell me why here, in Tibet, we have such dreadfully monotonous fare? I'm sick to death of Sampa and tea and Sampa and tea. Sometimes I can hardly cram the muck down." The Japanese looked at me with great understanding and even greater sympathy. "Ah, so you ask me, because I've tasted so many different kinds of food. Yes, and so I have. I have traveled extensively throughout the whole of my life. I've had food in England, Germany, Russia, almost everywhere that you can mention. In spite of my priestly vows, I have lived well, or at least I thought so at the time. But now my dereliction from my vows has brought me to grief." He looked at me and then seemed to jerk to life again. "Oh, yes, you asked me why such monotonous fare. I'll tell you. People in the West eat too much, and they have too great a variety of food. The digestive organs work on an involuntary basis, that is, they're not controlled by the voluntary part of the brain. As we teach, if the brain, through the eyes, has an opportunity of assessing the type of food which is going to be consumed, then the stomach can release the necessary quantity and concentration of gastric juices in order to deal with the food. If, on the other hand, everything is crammed down indiscriminately, and the consumer is busily engaged in idle talk all the time, then the juices are not prepared, digestion cannot be accomplished, and the poor wretch suffers from indigestion and later perhaps from gastric ulcers. You want to know why your food is plain? Well, the plainer, and within reason, the more monotonous the food one consumes, the better it is for the development of the psychic parts of the body. I was a great student of the occult. I had great powers of clairvoyance, and then I stuffed myself with all sorts of incredible concoctions and even more incredible drinks. I lost all my metaphysical powers, so that now I have come here to the Shakpori so that I may be attended, so that I may have a place where I can rest my weary body before leaving this earth. And when I have left this earth in just a few short months from now, the body breakers will do the job. They'll complete the task, which an indiscriminate admixture of drinks and food started. He looked at me and then gave me one of those queer jumps again and said, "Oh yes, my boy, you take my advice. You stick to plain food for all the days of your life, and you'll never lose your powers. Go against my advice and cram everything you can down your hungry gullet, and you'll lose everything. What will you gain? Well, my boy, you'll gain indigestion. You'll gain gastric ulcers together with a bad temper. Oh-ho! I'm going off. I can feel another attack coming." The Japanese monk, Kenji Takuchi, rose shakily to his feet and tottered off in the direction of the Lama's quarters. I looked after him and shook my head sadly. I should very much have liked to have been able to talk to him much longer. "What sort of foods were they? Did they taste good?" Then I pulled myself up with a jerk. Why tantalize myself when all I had before me was rancid buttered tea and sampa, which had been really burned so much that it was a charred mass, and in some way some strange oily compound had gotten into it? I shook my head and walked again into the hall. Later in the evening, I was talking to my guide, the Lama Mingyar Dondup. "Honorable Lama, why do people buy horoscopes from the peddlers down on the way?" My guide smiled sadly as he replied, "Of course, as you know, there cannot be any worthwhile horoscope unless it is individually prepared for the person to whom it is alleged to refer. No horoscope can be prepared on a mass production basis. The horoscopes sold by the peddlers on the road below are merely so that they can get money from the credulous." He looked at me and said, "Of course, Lobsang, the pilgrims who have these horoscopes go back home and show they have a souvenir from the Patella. They're satisfied, and so is the peddler, so why bother about them? Everyone's satisfied." "Do you think people should have horoscopes prepared for them?" I asked. "Not really, Lobsang, not really. Only in certain cases, such as your own case. Too often, horoscopes are merely used to save a person the effort of adopting a course of action upon his own responsibility. I'm very much against the use of astrology or horoscopes unless there is a definite, specific reason for it. As you know, the average person is like a pilgrim threading his way through the city of Lhasa. He cannot see the road ahead for the trees and the houses and the bends and the curves in the road. He has to be prepared for whatever is coming. We here can look down upon the road and see any obstructions, for we are at a higher elevation. The pilgrim, then, is like a person with no horoscope. We, being higher in the air than the pilgrim, are like people with the horoscope, for we can see the road ahead. We can see obstacles and difficulties, and thus should be in a position to overcome difficulties before they really occur. There is another thing which is troubling me greatly, Honorable Lama. Can you tell me how it is that we know things in this life that we knew in the past? I looked at him most anxiously, for I was always rather afraid of asking such questions, as really I had no right to be delving so deeply into matters, but he took no offense. Instead, he replied, "Before we come to this earth, Wabsang, we mapped out what we intended to do. The knowledge was stored in our subconscious, and if we could get in touch with our subconscious, as some of us can, then we should know everything that we had planned. Of course, if we should know everything that we had planned, there'd be no merit in striving to better ourselves, because we would know that we were working along a predetermined plan. For some reasons, sometimes a person will go to sleep or get out of his body while conscious and will get in touch with his overself. Sometimes the overself will be able to bring up knowledge from the subconscious and transfer it back to the body on earth, so that when the astral body returns to the flesh, there is knowledge in the mind of certain things that happened in a past life. It may be as a special warning not to commit a mistake which may have been committed for life after life. Sometimes a person has a great desire to commit suicide, as just an example. And if a person has been penalized life after life for doing that, then frequently they will have a memory of something about self-destruction, in the hope that such a memory will cause the body to refrain from self-destruction. I pondered upon all this, and then I walked to the window and looked out. Just below, there was the fresh green of the swampy area and the beautiful green of the willow trees. My guide broke into my reverie. "You are looking out of this window, Lhasang. Does it occur to you that you look out so frequently because you find the green so soothing to your eyes?" As I thought about it, I realized that I did instinctively see green after I'd been working at my books. Green, Lhasang, is the most restful color for the eyes. It gives ease to tired eyes. When you go to the Western world, you'll find that in some of their theaters, there is a place called the Green Room, where actors and actresses go to rest their eyes after having been subjected to smoke-filled stages and bright glaring footlights and floodlights. I opened my eyes in amazement at this, and I decided that I would pursue this matter of colors whenever the opportunity presented itself. My guide said, "I have to leave you now, Lobsang, but tomorrow come to me again because I'm going to teach you some other things." He rose to his feet, patted me on the shoulder, and went out. For some time I stood looking out the window, looking out at the green of the swamp grass and the trees which were so restful to the eyes. End of chapter 11. Chapter 12. I stood a little way down the path, looking down the mountainside. My heart was sick within me, and my eyes were hot with the tears I dared not shed. The old man was being carried down the mountain. The Japanese monk, Kenji Takuchi, had returned to his ancestors. Now the disposers of the dead were carrying his poor, shriveled old body away from us. Was his spirit even now wandering on a path lined with cherry blossoms? Or was he seeing the mistakes of his lifetime and planning his return? I looked down again before the men rounded a curve in the path, looked down at the pathetic bundle that once had been a man. A shadow came over the sun, and for a time I imagined that I saw a face in the clouds. Was it true, I wondered, that there were guardians of the world? Great spirit guardians who saw to it that man had suffering on earth in order to live? Why, they must be like school teachers, I thought. Perhaps Kenji Takuchi would meet them. Perhaps he'd be told that he had learned well. I hope so, for he had been a frail old man who had seen much and suffered much. Or would he have come down to the flesh again, reincarnate, so that he could learn more? When would he come? In some 600 years? Or now? I thought of it. I thought of the service I had just left. The service for guiding the dead. The flickering butter lamps, flickering like the flames of a feeble life. I thought of the clouds of sweet-smelling incense which seemed to form into living creatures. For a moment I had thought Kenji Takuchi had come among us again as a living being instead of propped up before us as a wizened corpse. Now, perhaps, he'd be looking at the Akashic record, that indelible record of all that has ever happened. Maybe he'd be able to see where he had gone wrong and remember for when he came again. The old man had taught me a lot. In his strange way, he'd been fond of me, talking to me as an equal. Now he was no more on the earth. Idly, I kicked a stone and scuffed my worn sandals in the ground. Had he a mother? Somehow I could not imagine him as young, as having a family. He must have been lonely, living amongst us strangers, so far from his own land, so far from the warm breezes and his own sacred mountain. Often he had told me about Japan, then his voice had grown hoarse and his eyes strange. One day he had shocked me by saying that people probed into occult matters when they'd be better off by waiting until they were ready, instead of trying to importune a master. "The master always comes when the student is ready, boy," he said to me. "And when you have a master, do everything he says, for only then you are ready." The day was becoming duller. Clouds were forming overhead, and the wind was beginning to whip up small stones again. Below me, in the plain, a small group of men appeared from the base of the mountain. Gently they placed their pathetic bundle on the back of a pony, mounted their own, and slowly rode off. I stared out across the plain until, at last, the small cortege vanished from my sight. Slowly I turned away and trudged up the mountain. End of chapter 12 and end of the Cave of the Ancients.